The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Today on Happy, Sad, Confused, Richard Jenkins on The Shape of Water, Step Brothers, and being the consummate character actor. Hey guys, I'm Josh Horowitz. Welcome to another edition of Happy, Sad, Confused, my podcast where I talk to cool actors, cool directors, and cool sidekicks like Sammy.
Cool
actors. K-E-W-L.
Cool actors. I'm cool. Sure Richard Jenkins loves being considered the cool actor.
I'm going to have to vet with you in the future the things I plan on saying. The problem is I don't plan on saying anything, as is evidenced by my shitty intros.
Oh, wow. Well,
hence your participation.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love when I'm not on them and I listen to them. It makes me laugh so hard.
It was really upsetting. Yes, Sammy started texting me the other day when she was clearly listening to one where I had to ride solo. And I'm insecure about it because it feels
just
like...
talking to yourself.
I am talking to myself.
Yeah, but like in call and response fashion.
It's a hard thing to do.
It's fascinating. It really is. It's like this is what happens in there.
And by in there, you mean in the brain?
In the brain, yeah.
Yeah, it's dark and
cold
in there.
You're doing great. Okay, great. Oh, let's talk about this. Okay.
I don't do that.
No, it's so good.
All right.
It's so good.
Let's talk about someone that is so good and super cool.
Richard Jenkins. I know who you're talking about.
Richard Jenkins is the guest on this episode of Happy, Sad, Confused. His new film is The Shape of Water, which is directed by the great Guillermo del Toro. I had a chance to talk to Guillermo, actually, if you haven't listened to that podcast. We taped it way back when the film debuted at the Toronto Film Festival. So just go back into the archives a bit if you want to hear from Guillermo.
Is this... the movie you were seeing when you sat next to somebody special?
This was my special Benedict Cumberbatch time, yes.
And Benedict offered you some popcorn?
It was a magical experience.
That's why.
It was a really special time to be alive.
Okay.
So I still need to see the movie again because it's the greatest movie ever made because I shared popcorn with Benedict Cumberbatch.
You didn't even see the movie. You were just like, does Benedict like it?
No, I was just staring at him the entire time.
Is he eating the popcorn or just holding it as a prop?
Should I ask for more popcorn?
Yeah.
What's the etiquette?
And you like lick your hands and take some of his popcorn.
I got my own bag, just for the record. He gave me a whole bag of popcorn.
Why did he have...
Because when you're Benedict Cumberbatch, people just give you like 6 bags of popcorn.
Oh, so it was a charity.
Hey.
He wasn't like, you're my friend, here's some. He's like, why the fuck am I going to hold 2 bags of popcorn?
How many bags of popcorn has Benedict Cumberbatch ever given you?
You don't want to know.
Anyway, the movie that we saw while we had popcorn together was The Shape of Water, which comes from the wonderfully deranged and magical mind that is Guillermo del Toro. Guillermo's the best, and this one has garnered fantastic reviews. The brief summary of it is basically it's kind of a Beauty and the Beast tale. Sally Hawkins plays a woman who it takes place, I think, early 60s, I want to say, and she falls in love with kind of like a fish man, a mythical kind of creature played by the remarkable Doug Jones. Doug is the guy that's been in like virtually all of Guillermo's movies, from Pan's Labyrinth to Hellboy, and always kind of inhabits those fantastical creatures. And it's a story really about outsiders and about love, and it's kind of a mix of all kind of the genres that Guillermo's toyed with over the years. There's, there's magic and fantasy involved, and there's a bit of a musical vibe to it. It's gorgeous to look at, and it's filled with fantastic performances beyond just Sally and Doug. Richard Jenkins plays Sally's kind of best friend.
Who else is in it?
Michael Shannon's in it.
Michael Shannon.
A Yeah. Michael Stuhlbarg, who's coming up on the podcast very soon, is in it as well. It's a solid, great piece of work. I'm excited to check it out again very soon. And I was delighted to have Richard Jenkins on the show, who, of course, you probably know from – it could be any number of things. He was Oscar-nominated for his role in The Visitor. You remember that one? That was
yes.
a good, I'm glad you enjoyed
he
that one.
So good yeah. in that movie.
He was great in that one. And that was – we talk about that in this one. That was his – I think it was his first leading role, maybe his only leading role. He's one of those guys that just is always rises to whatever the occasion is. He can fit any number of different.
He's
kind
someone
of parts.
Who, like, if you see, you're like, oh my god, he was in yeah. this. You look at his IMDb page, you're like,
Flirting with Disaster. I don't know if you remember him in that one. He and Josh Brolin were kind of a couple in that one. Really fantastic in that, and of course, Step Brothers kind of also kind of revitalized his career, or at least introduced him to a new audience. And this one may end up getting him an Oscar nomination. He's getting great reviews for this. So really thrilled to talk to a guy that also, as you'll hear in the podcast, just seems like the most decent human beings. Like, he's been married for like 50 years.
Oh,
they've always lived in Rhode Island.
He
took the train in from Rhode Island for this. I mean, he honestly, like, I fell in love with him.
Did you like feel like you wanted to like do more since he came all the way from Rhode Island?
To be fair, he did us, and then I think he had a Q&A right after the podcast. So he was double duty, but
you
still.
You want some of the stale candy on my desk too?
Stale candy. Uh-huh. So that's Richard Jenkins. Let's just actually go right to the Richard Jenkins podcast conversation, because it's a long career and well worth talking about. He's one of those guys that probably hasn't done a lot of these kind of long form interviews, and damn it, he deserves time and respect.
Sure does.
He's one of the best out there. So go check out The Shape of Water. I believe it's out in New York and perhaps LA right now, and spreading around the country very, very soon. It's a special one. Enjoy this conversation with Richard Jenkins. Oh, and Sammy, what should I remind people?
Hey, I think it'd be cool if they would rate, review, and subscribe.
I almost forgot. And you weren't helping. You were checked out.
I completely forgot.
Guys.
But... Now that you said it, it's all I care about.
We're being serious.
Yes.
Just go to iTunes. Do me a solid.
Do it right now. Like right now. What are you doing?
What are you doing, dude?
Pull over.
Exactly. It honestly would mean a lot. Just go to iTunes, review, rate, and subscribe. Spread the good word of Happy, Sad, Confused. And then come back and enjoy this conversation with Richard Jenkins.
Yeah, press pause and then come back and press play.
And by the way, guys, not to toot our own horn, but we're cranking them out right now. We've got two more podcasts coming up this week with two other...
What if you lose your voice?
Me? Then that's what you're here for. You're subbing in.
The interviews could be like...
You could do a good Josh Horowitz imitation.
Yeah.
All right. Here's Richard Jenkins. I'm very pleased to be joined by Mr. Richard Jenkins. As you can hear from the squeaks, we're getting adjusted in our chairs on a rainy night in New York.
We're not outside, though.
No. Okay. Small favors. We at least have some shelter here. Thanks for making the trip. I know you're starting to spread the good word again on this this great film, this great performance, The Shape of Water, which I'm such a fan of.
Oh, thank you.
I first saw it in Toronto, I would imagine. Have you had a bit of a break from the press? Are you kind of like gearing up again?
Well, from Toronto, we went to London. I was just down in Savannah, film festival down there. It's a good way to go see places you haven't been.
Yeah, some good food in Savannah, hopefully.
Wasn't there long enough. We had one great meal. Okay. Yeah, one great meal.
Okay. You made the trip by train, I hear, today.
I always do.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I love trains. Yeah, I have a lot of family in D.C., so that's the way we travel back and forth.
They had to stop and check the brakes. About an hour outside.
Inspires confidence.
I was like, how do you do that? And there's a guy walking out, and I checked the brakes, and they came
old
back
school.
And said, it's fine.
Yeah.
On we go.
Do you get, how many times are you recognized on a trip like that? Does that happen often?
Yeah, happens all the time, you know. I mean, I don't get mobbed, but, you know, people are very nice.
Is it the right level of fame that you feel like you have? Are you manageable?
You forget when somebody comes up to you, you think you know them from someplace, you know, and then you realize, oh, okay, it's not that. It's Step Brothers or something.
Right. Know. Did it ramp up a lot with Step Brothers?
It did. Step Brothers. It's with an age group, it ramped up.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It widened the Richard Jenkins Appreciation Club.
Well, Dr. Doback. That's who they call me.
It's Doback. But then I guess you also get the – and I know Will was actually doing some press here in New York today for his new film. I would imagine you also are one of those guys that for years have gotten kind of like the people that are not sure what they know you from. And it's a lot of like, what, did we go to school? Were you my teacher? Kind of a thing.
A lot of guys – one guy came up to me one day and he said, is your name Roy? I said, no. He said, are you sure? I said, pretty sure.
I'm not that far out yet.
Okay, I'm Roy. That's who I am.
But what do you want me to be?
I'm school, or you know, how do? What do I know you from?
That must be such a painful. I mean, it's nice that people like want to acknowledge you in some way, but it's also like you don't want to start listing off your resume and be like, I don't know.
But yeah, I've done that. That's not good. You don't want to start doing that because once you start doing that, listing off movies, they go, no, didn't see it. No, didn't see it. I listed a movie I did, and he said, why would I ever see something like that? So I've stopped doing that. You don't do that.
Probably was.
Because you just say, what have I seen you in? I don't know what you've seen. So it's,
yeah. Well, you've had the kind of career, luckily, that from Step Brothers to The Visitor to, you know, Shape of Water, it draws different kinds of audiences,
which
is nice.
You know, you can tell, you know, older folks, The Visitor, older folks, younger than me, but Olive Kitteridge, I get that from, you know, so.
And for me, I think the first time I saw you on screen was Witches of Eastwick.
It was really my first – that was the first part I had in a movie.
Is that right?
But you
did Silverado, but that was kind of just you were there.
I said, howdy, and you can't do that, and they shot me, you know. So that that was really not – I think Jeff Goldblum, very funny man, said to me one day, who are you playing in Silverado as he was in it? And I said, Kelly. And there was this long pause. He went, oh, you're Kelly.
In that Jeff Goldblum kind of way. Amazing.
Brutal. It was brutal.
But Witches of Eastwick was, you know, I was telling you before when you walked in, I'm a child of the 80s, and that was a big one for me. And I'm such a, as every kind of film geek is, I think, like Guillermo, George Miller is just the gold standard for me. And he's been in here. We talked about, you know, Fury Road, of course. But that was a tough one for him. I know he's talked about how, like, that was...
He said he'd never come back to the States and do another movie. I don't think he has, either.
Yeah, he's done it kind of on his own terms ever since.
Yeah.
Did you sense that as kind of...
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. He talked about it. He just said, this is crazy. He said, you know, he's a really interesting guy. I mean, he's so smart.
And a doctor.
He's really an interesting dude. And it was – they wouldn't let me on the set the first day I was shooting because they didn't believe that I was in it. I live probably 60 miles from where we shot in Massachusetts. Mm. And I pulled up to the – then the guard wouldn't let me through. And I said, you guys, I'm in this movie. And he goes, yeah, you and everybody else in town.
Oh, God. No, I've got some actual stuff to do. I get to watch Veronica Cartwright throw up for extended periods of time.
Yeah, cherry pits. No, but – and then some grip walked by and the guard said, hey, you know who this guy is? He said, never seen him before.
It's been uphill since then.
Yeah, it was uphill.
When did you start to feel comfortable in your own abilities as an actor? I mean, do you ever do, really?
I mean, you start to, you know, it's a long, it's a long process. It's never ending. Hopefully it never ends. I mean, you know, it'll end someday, but you learn constantly as you go. But you know, once you think you figured it out, you're in trouble, I think. But I think I got comfortable with who I was as an actor maybe 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Did that coincide with any specific experience or film? Or?
Well, it was before The Visitor.
Yeah, I was going to say.
And I don't even know. I felt, because that was the first time I'd ever had a lead in a film, right. And last. it was one of those things where I felt, I think I can do this. It's not that. It's not that you can act the part. It's, will people want to watch it? That's really the fear that most actors have, I think.
When you walk onto a set like Shape of Water with someone like Guillermo, like, do you have it already all kind of figured out in your head?
I have none of it figured out in my head. None of it.
So that must still be a degree of fear the first couple of days when you're kind of everyone searching together.
It is. Well, we rehearse for about a week or a week and a half.
Okay.
But that's really kind of just to get to know each other, and Sally and I became really friends, and which was really important, I think, for the movie. But no, you don't. I don't know. I have no idea what I'm going to do. I mean, I have an idea.
Sure, you have a game plan,
it
but you're
like
ready
a lazy actor, isn't it?
I haven't read the script.
I read it that day. I read it. My line, bullshit. Yeah, no. But it's until you're there, until you're living in that apartment with her coming in and going out, you know, to once you make a decision about something, this is how I feel, once you make a decision about something, it's dead, dies. Now, it doesn't, you know, if you say, that's what I'm going to do here, then you destroy any possibility of doing anything else.
Any life that could possibly seep into
that.
You
miss things that come at you. You're not aware of the truth is you have to live your life on the screen. That's what you have to do.
Well, and especially on something like this, where I know you've talked about this, and I can tell from seeing the film, the sets are just remarkable. I mean, like the world that Guillermo creates is both feels authentic to the time, but is a heightened reality that only he can create. And that must kind of just like fire off synapses, like when you walk onto it. Like,
loved it. I called my wife and I said, you have to see this set. This is what I thought making movies was going to be about when I was in college. Look like this, where everything is authentic and nothing is real. Which is so hard to do. All the books and the cats and the sketching and the charcoal and the bed and the refrigerator. And yet it wasn't real.
Right.
It was otherworldly. It was a piece of art. It was what movies can do that they don't do very often.
Well, it must inspire. I mean, it's part of why I've just loved everything Guillermo's ever done, whether it works 100% or not. He's put so much time and meticulous care into creating both what you see on screen and everything kind of like that's bursting out of the seams, outside of the frame. You can't ever say he has not put in the work of like really creating a world.
Like nobody I've ever worked with.
Right.
I mean, that's what he does that better than anybody. And it's a conscious, he knows consciously what he wants to do. Mm. And he knew what this film was going to look like. He knew what it was going to sound like. And, you know, he told us, but I still didn't get it until I saw it.
Did you worry when you come onto a set like that, again, knowing the kind of the craftsman he is, like, am I just going to be a pawn in his little chess game where there's not going to, I'm not going to have that room to breathe that I need as an actor?
I would demand it.
We'd have a conversation.
But, you know, that's the difference between now and a few years ago. I wouldn't do that if I thought that's what it was going to be.
Right.
You know, I read the script. I loved the part. The part was three-dimensional. It was this man with his own life, his own world, that ends up, you know, leaving that world and helping somebody else. But you know, he wrote these three-dimensional characters, and that's why I said yes to the film.
Yeah.
And I knew, I mean, I didn't know, but I was pretty sure he was going to film that. But what you see immediately with Guillermo is he says, let's see what you have to bring.
He has so much empathy also for, like, every kind of character. Like, he obviously has a clear love of the outsider, of the person that feels like they're not being seen literally or figuratively, and that's what this film it feels like it's an ultimate distillation of what he's all about, and that like virtually every character is unseen in a way on
and
the fringes.
That's why it takes place in 1962,
right?
Because that's the time when everybody's let's go back to that
good old days,
let's make America great again. Right. Yeah, well, you know, and I grew up in 1962. I was a freshman or sophomore in high school. It was great, but I was a white man,
right?
You know, if you were anything other than
literally that, anything other than that,
it wasn't so great. You know, it was a great time for me. You know, but it's really, until I saw the movie, I knew what we were doing. Mm. But the degree in which I think the brilliance of putting it in that year is just, that to me was spectacular. Yeah. And I didn't realize that until I saw it.
Yeah. You mentioned kind of like the time you grew up in, and also the place where you grew up. I'm curious, like, was it a diverse place at all? Like, did
no.
you?
No. No. No, no. No, there were no gay people in my high school until our 40th reunion. And then, you know, but you just didn't come out. You just didn't say you were gay. And you didn't. There were no African Americans in my town. I grew up in a farm town.
Yeah.
It was great. I mean, I had a wonderful childhood. It was 60 miles west of Chicago. It was a safe, wonderful place to grow up.
Yeah.
But you didn't really know the world. the only way you knew the world was through movies and books. That's the only way you could see the world. But, you know, I had a great time.
You had an early love of film, right?
I loved it from the minute I started going to the movies, yeah. Yeah.
What are your first indelible memories of movie going?
Haley Mills.
Okay, all right, sure.
I just fell in love with Haley Mills, and I thought I could go to London and be her gardener. I had this fantasy.
What a romantic.
That, and then she would see me out there planting tomatoes and fall for me.
So being an actor was the closest thing you could get to get. This will get me close to Haley Mills.
I mean, I was just. I used to go to the movies every Friday and Saturday night. It didn't matter what was on. We just went. Saw it. Sometimes we stayed twice. That's back in the day. You could sit and watch it again. But I loved movies. But you say, how do you do that?
Right.
And nobody in my town had ever done that. Somebody who was on Raymond on
Perry Mason.
Perry Mason, Della Street.
What's her name? Yeah.
Barbara Bain. Isn't that awful?
Yeah,
I can't remember her name, but
it's William Katz's mom. I remember the actor William Katz was.
Yes,
right.
Yes, yeah. And her husband, his father was Wild Bill Hickok.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Oh, was her? Oh gosh, it's terrible.
That's okay. I grew up loving Perry Mason. That was a great show.
But she was from DeKalb, and that would always come up if she was ever in Chicago or Illinois. So
did you express at the time a secret dream, or was it a not so secret dream, or was it?
I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to go about it. But I told my parents. I did a play in eighth grade, and I came home and I told my parents I wanted to be an actor. And I didn't know this, but my father just freaked out. And he told my mother, I will not allow this. It's not going to happen. He'll starve to death. This is not how a grown-up makes a living. You don't do that.
Well, he had no point of reference.
None. Yeah. And so my mother said, relax. And he said, I'm not going to relax. I will not allow it. So she called up the theater teacher at my junior high school. And I didn't know any of this. They did an article on me in the local paper, and somebody sent me the article, and this theater teacher told this story. My parents were both dead when she told. So anyway, she said, my mother called her up and said, you have to talk to my husband. He's being unreasonable. And, God bless my mother. She's the sweetest. And so she said, well, put him on the phone. And he got on the phone. He said, I will not allow this. She said, no, wait a minute. He said, no, I will not allow it. She said, okay. You go ahead, you put your foot down, and you say no, but you have to understand that when you do that, he will never forgive you for the rest of his life. And if you're willing to live with that, you go right ahead.
Wow.
And I never knew my father was against me being an actor. My father, I thought he was my biggest supporter and my biggest fan.
That's a beautiful story. That's amazing.
It is an
what
amazing
a gift.
Story.
What a,
but I never got a chance to thank him or my mom. But I did go back and thanked her, the drama teacher. I knocked on her door, and she was very ill. And we talked for an hour. And I just said, I had no idea.
That's amazing. Yeah. You're bringing me to tears.
Well, amazing. Me too. I read it, and all I could think of was, you know, listen, if you have parents and you love them, tell them you love them.
Yeah.
Because you don't know what they did.
The secret sacrifices that were happening behind the bedroom door that you have no idea. The conversations.
I mean, my father, I was gobsmacked. I had no idea. I thought he was pushing me to be an actor. And all the while, he was terrified.
And not to mention, it took a while, at least in terms of the film career. We'll get to that. But, like, were you making a living? Like, you were doing a lot of theater. You moved to Rhode Island, where you still live. You making a decent living?
No.
Like,
no, I was making a check every week. But my amazing wife was, she went back. She started to teach. She's a choreographer and a dancer. And she ran the Arts Magnet program in a high school in Rhode Island. She ran the dance program. So if it wasn't for her, I was working in regional theater making, you know, like.
Right.
And then we had a daughter. Our daughter was born, and it was, like, really scary how we're going to educate this kid. So I went out to L.A. for about 10 months thinking I could find my way.
Is this in your 20s or 30s?
I was in my 20s. 8.
Which, by the way, is still like a decade or so before the film career started to
go. It was about 37 or 8 I started doing movies. Yeah, 36 or 7.
So clearly that trip did not...
I did not do well out there. I, as they say, got my ass handed to me. And I couldn't... Nobody would see me. I couldn't get in anywhere. I mean, I was this goofy-looking 28-year-old with corduroy pants because it was cold when I left Rhode Island, and it was 100 degrees. And so everywhere I went, I was sweating. I mean, I couldn't get anywhere. And I said I had to borrow $200 from my uncle, who was in the Air Force in San Bernardino, for gas money to get back to my wife and our daughter stayed at her parents' house for all that time waiting. And they came back, yeah, and so I came back and said, it's not going to happen.
That's got to be a tough road trip back by yourself,
It was really depressing. It was really depressing. But, you know, I'm glad it happened. I'm glad I went.
And then in the ensuing 8 or 9 years, you're in Rhode Island. Your wife's still making a decent living, so you are able to get by.
And I start doing plays at different theaters. I didn't want the Yale rep. And then John Pasquin, who is Jo Beth Williams, her husband is a wonderful director, and I was at the O'Neill Center doing theater there. And he said, why don't you come do a play at the Longworth Holiday with me? And I said, no, John, I just done play at the Yale Rep. I said, I don't want to. He said, no, come. And I said, no. And he finally said, let's do this. So I said, okay. I did it. And one night, Sandy Dennis, remember Sandy Dennis?
Sure, yeah, yeah.
And Bill Tresh, who was a manager, her manager, he had a place up in Connecticut in the weekends, and they came to see Holiday, and she said, sign him. And he came backstage afterwards, and I was 36, and he said, I want to sign you. I said, okay.
This isn't supposed to happen this
Great.
Way.
It isn't. It never, but, you know, I'd forgotten this. I'd forgotten about it because it was like, I'm going to have to make my way doing this.
Right.
Because I wasn't in New York. Nobody knew who I was.
Right.
It's not like I was in the New York theater scene. So he said, what do you want to do? I said, I want to be in movies. And he said, okay. I said, I don't live in New York. He said, I don't care where you live. But if I call you for an audition, you got to get on the train or the car, however you do this, and you got to come. You can't say it's too far. I said, okay. I said, but, you know, just don't get me an audition at 7 o'clock in the morning. You know, try to get it in the afternoon. So I did that for, I don't know, 10, 12 years.
Wow.
Sometimes I would go in 4 or 5 times a week. And that's before the Cellar Express. I was taking the – because it was cheaper, too. It was like sometimes a five-hour train ride.
Yeah, you've gotten to know the train routes quite well over the last 30-plus years, I'm sure.
And you'd go into an audition, and you'd have a line like, okay, freeze.
Back on the train.
Thank you. And I go, oh, God, I got 5 hours to go on a train.
to think about what you just did.
That one line. And you get home, and the phone rings. Can you come in tomorrow? Okay, yeah, go back. And so that was – but, you know – I didn't complain. I think about it now, and I think, oh my God, that was what do you? Do? But it was a chance. I mean,
speaks to your love and passion for this thing, which is more than a job to you, which is obviously
it's kind of who I am.
Yeah,
I've always been an actor. I can't imagine me doing anything else. I drove a laundry truck and had 5 accidents in 2 months. You know, it's like my dad said he was a dentist. He said, you should be a dentist. I said, Dad, that means I have to graduate from dental school. And I was like, I don't think I can do that. But, you know, it never occurred to me to do anything else, ever. And
well, but by the time – so did working on something like Witches of Eastwick kind of
that changed
jumpstart?
Yeah, that changed it.
Just by being in a high-profile film, and you were holding your own, and you know, you immediately, like, again, I remember that performance because, I mean, you know, you didn't have the biggest part, but it worked. You felt a part of that world.
It changed everything. It changed everything. All of a sudden, agents were interested in me, and it's all because of Bill Tresh.
Crazy.
Who took a chance, and Sandy Dennis, who I did thank, but.
People don't often talk about them. You've already cited a few, like 3 or 4 people, like the people that prop up an actor's career.
There's so many.
Whether it's a teacher, an agent, a parent, it's.
And then you go along, and then something else happens. Somebody else comes into your life.
Sure.
And then it changes. Sometimes it goes this way. Sometimes it goes down. Sometimes up. And I have five or six people like that. Yeah. Just changed my life.
You a couple filmmakers and films I wanted to mention. You worked with Mike Nichols a couple times.
Twice, yes. I love Mike Nichols.
I mean, every actor that's worked with him, well, that's the first line out of their mouth. What was about the experience of working with him that felt special?
Well, I auditioned for him for a play he was directing in New York. Mm. And it was, what was the name of it? I don't think it was. It was like William Hurt, Harvey Keitel, and all these stars. Yeah. And it was a big hit. And they asked me to understudy every part in the play. I said, I can't do that. So I thought I'd never hear from him again, right. And then he called me up to do Wolf.
Yeah.
And I just loved him. I loved him immediately. The first day on the set, I play this kind of vague cop.
Right.
That was not very clear in the story. But I played a lot of those parts. But he was interested.
Richard will make it work.
He wanted to know what we And I said, I don't think he's very smart. I think he just seems to me to ask kind of questions that the questions are not really probing. And so the first day on the set, I'm sitting at my desk, and they say, action. And the phone rings. The phone's not supposed to ring. And there's a Mike Nichols yells from off camera, "It's your mother on line two."
Wow.
So I pick the phone up. I go, "Yeah, Mom." And there's nobody on the phone. So I just start talking. I say, "What? What is it, Mom? What do you want?" "No, Mom, you don't put the cable box on three. You put the television on three." And it was just like, and I said, what are we having tonight? Again? We're having it again? Okay. All right, Mom. Yeah, when I get home.
I'm a simple mama's boy kind of character.
I hung the phone up, and I hear from the back, "So you live with your mother."
That's amazing. You know,
that's how he got to it. He just wanted to see what would happen.
So did he engineer for the phone to ring, or was he just making use of that moment?
It was his idea. Yeah, he did the... He was incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a whole thing where I couldn't type very well. I needed whiteout. This guy was just not too bright.
Well, again, speaking to like Mike's, and similar to what you're talking about, Guillermo, like filling in the smaller characters with lived in details that make that world come to life.
Yeah. Yeah. He was, I think his assistant director became a producer, said, "I've known him for 30 years. I've never heard him repeat himself." Wow. He was one of these guys that just was
always the smartest, interesting guy in the room.
It's like kind of like Guillermo.
Yeah,
Guillermo is. I would go to Guillermo and ask him about stuff that had nothing to do with the movie, just to see if he'd thought about it.
You seem like the smartest person I've met. Let's test that.
I just wanted to say, have you seen every single movie? Yeah, I think you have. Yeah,
yeah.
But he knows who he is. He's incredibly articulate. And he comes from a real point of view, which was Mike Nichols. Mike Nichols was he was amazing.
Definitely another unique filmmaker in their own right, in a much different kind of way, is David O. Russell, the least.
It's great.
I mean, Running with Disaster is, again, was such a wonderful piece of work and an amazing ensemble.
That was another one that changed it.
I would imagine.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And David, I'd done a few things, but he put Josh and I together, Josh Brolin, and we read together, and then I went down we read it separately, and I went down, and they said, "You want to bring you back and read with Josh?" And I said, "Josh, just come on, let's go." I go, "I don't really want to." Josh, "What are you talking about?" I said, "I don't think he's going to use me, So we went up and we read, and we just had a ball.
Every character is so fascinating in that film. Like, you could say that on all of his films, but like that very unlikely, you've never seen a pair depicted like that in a film. These like ATF agents, two gay men, anytime you wouldn't see, you still would see that in
a
film.
Guillermo said, "That's one of the reasons I cast you, is that you were a man who happened to be gay."
Yeah, it wasn't a flamboyant, crazy depiction. It was a very lived in.
But that was just one fun day after the other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Brolin, I know, is another character, a smart guy, but a very smart, interesting guy.
And a really good actor.
Oh my
gosh!
We've discovered it more and more in recent years.
It's really good, really good.
It seems like you mentioned like Fording kind of like jump-starting things. Like you started to work with whether you were gravitating towards them or the directors were gravitating towards you. City Pollack and Clint Eastwood. You're starting to like accumulate this nice roster of filmmaker.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Sydney, I did two things with. One, I just acted with him in, and one, he directed me, and we acted
together.
He was together.
A great actor, by the way.
He was a really good actor. I think he wanted to be an actor more than he did a director.
He was just one of those guys that, again, like yourself, honestly, that never a false note. Just felt like a lived-in, real.
But it's funny, when you're acting with him, he would cut, and he goes, how was that?
Oh, no. It's a little insecure.
Yeah, so is it?
That's amazing.
Oh, well, shall we ask the director? Oh, you're the director. Oh.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, he was. Sydney was great. Sydney, I think I heard that he wanted to see the visitor, a tape of the visitor. Yeah. He was very sick at the time.
Oh, wow.
And I don't know if he ever did, but he was great. Sydney was great.
By the time you got to the visitor, which... you know, fair to say, became an unlikely, you know, mini kind of phenomenon. It, you know, got you an Academy Award nomination. This was the great Tom McCarthy. But I know you even had trepidation, not about the part, but about, like, are we really going to make this with me in a leading role? You said before you hadn't ever been the leading guy.
No.
That, again, this is not one of those things that happens.
No, it doesn't happen. And he called me and said, I knew him. I didn't know him very well. Mm. But this is my agent. This is my agent, Rhonda Price, who is Tom's agent. And she kept shoving movies of mine to him because she had been reading the script he was writing.
Right.
And she said, this is Richard. This is Richard. So he knew me, but he didn't. So she's giving him movies. So then he called me up. And we went out to dinner in L.A., and I just said, okay. We were both working out there in different movies. He was acting in a movie. Went to dinner, we talked, and had a nice time. And then about 6 months later, he called me up and said, I wrote this part for you. I want you to tell me if you're interested in doing it. And, okay, he sent me the script, and it was just like, I mean, it was... I said to my wife, who never reads things that I'm doing, I said, you have to read this and tell me if it's as good as I think it is.
Am I just deceived because it's a leading part, or is it actually as great as it seems?
And it's just the writing was so brilliant.
Yeah.
And so he called me up the next day and said, do you want to do this? And I said, Tom, nobody's going to give you money to make this movie with me in this part. And he said, that wasn't my question. You let me worry about that. Do you want to do it? And I said, you bet. So that was the...
Had you come close to kind of like getting the kind of leading role that
I never was up for leading roles like
really?
That. No, not really. I mean, I'm a character actor, you know.
And is that something that at some point you kind of like made your peace with, or like at a certain point you're like, you know what, I'm getting to work with great people. These are rewarding parts, well, and it's just not on the cards.
It's got to be on the page. You know, there you go through times where you have to do whatever comes along just because you have children to educate, and you want to be an actor and you want to keep busy and you want to keep working, but that day comes when you can say no, yes, yes, no.
Right.
And that's a nice day because you don't have to do – you know, no, they're not going to – Warner Brothers is not going to put $100 million up and say, hey, let's put Richard Jenkins in this part.
It's upsetting to me to hear that, you know, you kind of made light of it. But like in the wake of The Visitor, you know, which was a success and got you an Oscar nom.
Yeah.
It sounds like you didn't get other opportunities to be the guy. It doesn't need to be a $100 million movie. About $5 or $10 million movie.
Yeah, I did.
Okay.
Yes, yes. And but it's still hard. You know, it's not – you know, my career changed after that, really changed after that. That's the one that really changed. But, you know, it's who I am. I mean, I'm a character actor. But, you know, it doesn't mean I'll do crappy parts.
Right. Right. One film that I do want to mention, because I'm obsessed with, and I've talked to Matt Reeves a number of times, it was my favorite film of that year, was Let Me In.
Yeah.
Matt, I put at the highest ranks of the filmmakers working today, and I know he's, you know, very meticulous and has his own method, but he knows what he wants. And I've seen that movie many times, and I just love so much about that movie. I don't have a specific question, except I just want to hear kind of like what your experience was. And, you know, there's a lot of tough things about that character. It's not, you know, not saying much, under prosthetics for some key sequences. Mm-hmm. There's the car crash. Like, it's again, an interesting challenge, I would imagine.
From my perspective, I don't have a lot of lines to remember. That's good. No, I liked Matt. I liked the part because anything was possible with that part. You know, he gave me the freedom to kind of figure it out. We kind of came up with the garbage bags and mm-hmm. and all that stuff. And what would you do if you didn't have money and if you were trying to make a costume to or keep the blood off you? What would you do?
Sure.
So all that stuff was really interesting and fun. And I just love the guy too. But you know he's going to be an important director when you're working with him. You just know he is. You know that car crash was just. It was amazing.
Without going into like a 2-hour masterclass on filmmaking, how was that even achieved? This is essentially one continuous shot.
I don't know if he wants you to.
Okay, but not even remove the magic. That's all good.
I wouldn't say it unless he said it was okay.
What about your final scene in the film, which I find really moving, again, thanks to Giacchino's score and your performance and Chloe's performance. Again, you've kind of like been burned totally alive, and you sacrifice yourself to this, this kind child.
Of what he's done his whole life.
Yeah.
You know, this is what I was playing, that I met her the same age as the young boy meeting her now,
right.
And I've aged, and she hasn't, and I've been her caretaker, and my life is devoted to her.
Yeah,
and I see the writing on the wall. I see the kid coming in,
right?
Because I can't do it as well anymore. You know,
yeah,
I'm screwing up, and it was an interesting part. It was it was a really fun part for an actor to deal with. Yeah.
On the flip side, there's no segue to Step Brothers, but we have to mention Step Brothers because I don't know if you, maybe a love-hate relationship is probably wrong. There's so all good that's come of it, but like there's probably a disproportionate amount of attention you get for that role.
Well, yeah, you
which
do.
Is kind of
it's the nature of the beast.
Right.
I mean, it was a very popular movie, and it was popular, but after it hit DVD, that's
went to another level.
Nuts. Yeah.
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 Yeah. Adam McKay's fascinating in his own right in different ways. Like, I mean, I've been on set where he's been shooting, and I know he, like, you know, he's on the bullhorn tossing out lines to people. Was that something that you were comfortable with, or something?
I mean, David does that too.
Oh, really?
Yeah, David. It depends. I mean, yeah, Adam said, you know, we'll do the script 2 or 3 takes, and then we'll kind of veer off. I said, we didn't get through one take.
Right.
I mean, these guys can't stop. I mean, they're just – but everything they say is just hysterical.
Oh, yeah.
And then Adam will give you – Adam came up to me during the California wine mixer. That's the other thing I hear. People always say, the fucking California wine mixer. but he came up to me and he said, go tell the guys that you wanted to be a dinosaur when you were a kid. And I said, what? He said, just go tell them that you wanted to be a dinosaur. I said, Adam, what are you talking about? He goes, no, just go tell them that you... So I went over and I came off and I... And of course, John and Will are going, Dad, that's impossible. You can't be... And I came back and I said, well, that won't be in the movie. And he went, oh, yeah. Well. I mean, it's come on. If you're going to make Step, if you can't have fun making Step Brothers, then you should look for another job.
And it's very interesting. You play unhinged very well, like angry and
well, those guys do it to you.
Yeah, right. That was an acting. That was just
I mean, those guys, whatever you say to them, they have an answer for
it.
I mean, I think I come up with this good line to John. He's got an answer for everything.
Yeah.
And it's like after a while.
They, as you well know, those guys in New York always asked about a sequel. I saw Will talking just recently about the fact that the closest they came was a treatment where they would live with you
in
like retirement community. Did you ever like read anything on that? Or
I didn't
like...
read it, but Adam, I saw Adam one day. He goes, we're going to do a sequel. And I said, oh, good. And then it never happened. I think it might be okay if we didn't.
Right. I think either way, we're fine. Like, it could be fun, a fun experience, but hey, there are worse things than to leave a classic like that alone.
Well, we better hurry up.
Don't worry.
I'm going to be in the nursing home by the time.
You know, we've referenced, you know...
There'll be orderlies.
Stop. Just enough. The fact that you make your life and have for many, many years in Rhode Island, which is not... you might be the first guest on my podcast that does that and makes that work. You know... From the outside in, it seems like you've I don't know how you got there, but you cracked a code in kind of like a work-life balance pretty well. You know, you've been married for nearly 50 years. You have two kids. You're living away from the...
And I have a new grandchild.
Oh, nice. Congratulations.
Thank you.
From the insanity that is both New York and L.A., but yet you're able to work with the best directors. Is, you know, in retrospect, what's the best decision that you think you made to kind of like arrive at this kind of nice balance of work life?
I don't think I made a decision. I don't think it was ever a decision. It just... If you look back on your life and you see things that you just said, oh, okay, or no, I don't think so. Mm. It meant nothing at the time, but you see that, oh, my God, if I'd said yes to that, that would have been entirely different. I think dumb luck is a lot of it. I do. I think in careers and in your life, I'm incredibly fortunate, knock on wood. I have an amazing family and loving and smart. And my wife and I, she's a choreographer, and I direct sometimes in the theater. I used to direct more. I stopped. And now we do things together. We do musicals.
Nice.
And we co-direct and she choreographs. And
cool.
It's we've done two now, and it's just really fun. It's really fun.
Have you done stage work here in the city? Have you worked here in the...
Never on stage, no.
Really?
No, never. Well, I did a couple of workshops, but never... Never on stage, no.
So what is the criteria now that, you know, especially in the last decade plus, I would imagine there's an actual degree of choice because, you know, as you reference, like that's...
There is.
I think that's the thing that most people don't realize about great actors is that there's very often little choice. It's like take what's available and let the wind take you where you will. But at this point in your career, you get to kind of steer it a little bit.
I don't turn down movies that, you know... Tom Cruise accepts, you know, but I, you know, I have options.
Yeah.
Because but there just seems to be no reason to do something if you don't love it.
Right.
Now.
Are you relieved, excited that, when did you first see Shape of Water? Before the festival circuit?
I came back to I had to grow the beard again and do one take, one added shot for the end holding Sally.
Mm-hmm.
And so I came back. I don't know when it was, but it was, he had a rough cut, not a rough cut. He had temp music and he had,
right.
And I said, I got to see this, you know, cause I don't usually not really crazy to see the movies,
sure.
But I watched it in a screening room and not a screening room, an editing room. And I mean, I got lost. I forgot I was in it. All of a sudden I show up again. I went, oh yeah. I mean, it just blew me away. And then I saw it in Venice.
Yeah. It's exciting to see the audiences fall in love with this one, and there's so much to love in it, as I've referenced. Like, you know, hopefully I think Sally's going to stop by, and I've talked to Guillermo on the podcast, and Mike, as you can imagine, Michael Shannon's been a regular, so, and not to mention Stuhlbarg and Octavia. It's like there's an embarrassment of riches here.
I know. It's incredible. And it was such fun to do.
Yeah.
I love Sally Hawkins. I just love Octavia's great. Michael, I've known... We actually, when I was nominated, he was nominated for the first time.
Right.
And we kind of knew each other a little bit and talked. And
sure.
I'd do panels with him, and he was hilarious.
Yeah.
He's just this kind of subversive guy.
To say the least.
And
yeah.
But I didn't really do any scenes with him here, but I saw him on set and everything.
I haven't really spent much time with Sally, but, I mean, she's obviously from, you know, the Mike Leigh stuff on. She's always been excellent. But this is, you know, that's a silent role, essentially.
And she has to be brilliant in this,
yeah,
for this movie to work.
Yes.
But she's the only one he wanted.
Which again speaks to his...
I don't think he would have done the movie if he couldn't have gotten her.
Because again, you can imagine like the nefarious like studio executives, like I don't know where Sally Hawkins is frankly on that list for a bankable movie. So I'm so thrilled that Guillermo used whatever clout he has to put her in it.
You know, I mean, she's just extraordinary in it. And I said to her, "You're my friend now, and there's nothing you can do about it.
We're in this together.
So stop fighting." You know? No, we just had such fun. We laughed a lot, and it was great. I, you know, this is the kind of the first I see a friendship on screen when I watch it. I go, oh, yeah, 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 You look like your friends.
Yeah.
You know, she's fantastic. And Octavia, hilarious.
Well, the good news is you all will be spending a bit of time together on this silly kind of award circuit, which has serves a good cause in spreading the good word for this film. I'm sure I'll see more of you on carpets, et cetera. You know, it's a great piece of work. And as you
carpets
can tell.
Carpets as in hair pieces?
Yeah, exactly. That's my euphemism. You know what I'm talking about.
Right.
No, as you can tell, I'm such a fan of both your work and this film in particular. And it's honestly been a real pleasure to catch up with you, man.
It's really great, isn't it?
It's film? Yeah. It's a special one.
Well, thank you. You made it easy.
And so ends another edition of Happy, Sad, Confused. Remember to review, rate, and subscribe to this show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm a big podcast person. I'm Daisy Ridley, and I definitely wasn't pressured to do this by Josh.